When I was at Texas A&M, Derek, I gave a it was a speech communications class, and we had to give a presentation. So I picked affirmative action, and this is what I said. I was the only, I think maybe it was one of the black person in the class. And so I said, how many of you in this class, your mothers own businesses? And hands went up. And I said, how many of your mothers, to your knowledge, have received city, county, state, federal contracts? Hands went up. I said, congratulations. Affirmative action is paying for your college. Man, these white folks, they were aghast. And I said, oh, I'm sorry. Your mamas are benefiting from affirmative action. Your mamas are getting contracts. They had never had somebody tell them that. See, this is just the moment, as far as I'm concerned, where you got to call folk out and say, yes, you are. Maybe we should come up, use the phrase, I just say DEI dollars, bowling for DEI dollars. Oh, you got some DEI dollars? You got some DEI dollars? Oh, you got some DEI dollars. And then use placards and call them out. And then also call out all these women's groups. Matter of fact, I think somebody should, one of these conservative women's groups, go pull a roster and see how many of them have businesses and how do they get contracts and go, man, look at y'all with those DEI dollars. Mm-hmm. To me, that's how you got to fight and call these folk out.
You know, Roland, I think all of Trump hires are DEI hires. They all white men, right? I do agree that we need to call them out. Because here's the thing, though, Roland, and I know you here in Atlanta with us, they don't use the term DEI for them. They use the word legacy, Roland. Your legacy. So you go to Harvard for free because of legacy. You go to Yale for free, your legacy. They don't use the same vernacular. Listen, since last year, Roland, over 30 states have implemented some form of DEI law to either restrict any form of DEI. 30 states. So what do you think is going to happen come January? In fact, 2 days ago, Roland, Trump used the word reparation. He's going to give 3 million white men reparations. He said that's their reparation for those blacks who went to HBCUs. So we do need to call them out, but it requires political courage. Roland, you know as well as I'm in Georgia, the largest black caucus in the United States. What will we do in this manner to do exactly what you just called for us to do? Call folks out, call some of my colleagues who are white women and say, you are receiving dollars. They won't do that, Roland. You know that and I know that, because they don't want to exercise political courage to get that done.
Well, again, I just think that if you want to expose people for their hypocrisy, you got to call them by name. You got to name check them. You got to expose them. And you got to say, oh, look at Miss DEI Dollars. Oh, she hates DEI, but she gets contracts because she's a woman. Baby, that's called good old affirmative action. I'm just saying that's what maybe should be done.
Well, that's it for this week. We thank you for listening and happy holidays.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
I have been researching rethinking growth since 2016, and I made 4 projects since then. For the documentary specifically, it takes so much time to research. It is articles, it's journals, it's books, it's podcasts, it's so many things that you're consuming, because unlike a narrative film or pilot, you write it and then you shoot exactly what you wrote. The documentary, you can have points of what you want to discuss, but you have to, it's a puzzle, you have to slowly bring it together. Even after production, you're still like piecing the movie together how it should be. And so I knew that I wanted to build my portfolio. I also wanted to build my directorial voice and know what my directorial voice was. And I knew that I wanted to lead a few more teams before I got to Dixie Grown, because I knew the impact that it needed. I knew the seriousness that it needed. I knew the focus that it needed.
Chanel Dupree, founder of Artistic Laughter Production, award-winning screenwriter and director. Dupree has recently produced and directed a documentary titled You Think You're Grown, Dismantling Adultification. The production highlights sociological perception of African-American girls as older and less innocent than their peers affected their lives in significant ways. This bias often stems from stereotypes that wrongly assume African-American girls' physical features are more in line with those of adults rather than children. In her film, Dupree shares how adultification affected her personally. Other women in the production describe extreme punishments in school, inappropriate attention from older men, and the negativity they receive from various sources, including teachers, peers, and social media alongside sociological norms. I'm John L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, You Think You're Grown with Chanel Dupree, In Black America.
Slavery plays a huge part. Black children were never seen as children. Black girls were never seen as innocent. From the moment they were born, they were cattle. They were workers. They were immediately there to help the business. And a beautiful, beautiful professor, oh God, in my documentary, she says that a lot of mothers had to prepare their daughters mentally and spiritually for rape. Let's really sit with that. How do you prepare the mind, the body, the soul, the spirit for it to be attacked by age 10? By age 8, these little girls were already in line to bear children.
According to a new report released by Georgetown University, adultification of African-American girls is a common occurrence. Beginning when they are 5 years old and continuing through age 19, African-American girls are viewed as more adult than their white counterparts. And this adultification happens for a reason. Dating back to slavery, African-American women have been stereotyped as Jezebel, the Sapphire, and the Mammy. The report found that these stereotypes are alive and well today and shape our perceptions of African-American girls as well as African-American women. In a documentary, You Think You're Grown, Dismantling Adultification, producer-director Chanel Dupree dissects the ways in which seemingly harmless rhetorical question has been posed to African-American girls throughout history to control their behavior and diminish their self-worth. Recently, In Black America spoke with Chanel Dupree.
I am a Brooklyn baby, born and raised in Brownsville, one of the hardest neighborhoods to get through, but it had a lot of love and a lot of community at times. And living in such an integrated and beautiful and Black community like Brooklyn, it really shaped me as an artist, especially as a Black woman.
Chanel, do you have any brothers and sisters?
Oh, no, I don't. I'm an only child.
I understand. So when did you become interested in filmmaking?
Ooh, well, I've always been interested in filmmaking. I was that kid. My favorite movie back in the day was Boomerang, The Five Heartbeats, and Malcolm X. And I would run them back and forth, consistently rewinding and watching shots. And then I would get to the end of the film, at the end of the credits, when the director would do a whole commentary on the film. And I was a theater kid at first, and that was my start into the business. I started at 9 years old. And once I got to a performing arts high school, shout out to Brooklyn School for Music and Theater, they trained us as actresses, and they said, to be a great actress, you have to know a great script. And when I got a chance to write my first script, I was like, this is an out-of-body experience. This is exactly what God put me on this earth to do. And that's when it started. I started directing plays and then eventually films.
And what was that first script?
Oh my God, it was called The Rhythm Within. I was very young when I went natural, and I was in a predominantly black school, and apparently that was a very big issue. And I wasn't expecting that because I'm like, we all black. We all got curly hair, don't we? And there was a lot of like bullying and backlash that I had to maneuver through, and I wrote a script and a play based off of that.
Do you find other African-American women involved in this industry?
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much untapped artists and gems out there. They haven't gotten their big break, but just incredible women in the playwriting industry, in the screenwriting world, and directing. I'm constantly in awe by like the community I have in the indie world. And I'm just excited when one person or a group of us finally like get into the hemisphere, because I see talent every day.
Prior to your latest offering, the documentary, You Think You're Grown, Dismantling Adultification, in 2021, you did a dark comedy called Next Stop. Talk to us about that.
Yes. So, you know, growing up, we are told where our lives should be by certain times. And 2021 was in the midst of the, you know, biggest, you know, pandemic that we have seen in recent times. And I wrote this surrealistic dark comedy about this woman having to leave her apartment and go stay with her mom, and all of what that means to be 30 years old and having to go back home, all of the guilt and the doubt and the disappointment that you may feel with yourself and also with like the circumstances around you. And what does it mean to have to go back to a not so happy place when you are supposed to be so established and so stable?
And who made up the team for that particular project?
An incredible cinematographer, Kenny, my producer that was also on You Think You Grown, Lee Evans. She actually was an actress in the movie. And I had a wonderful gaffer who was also on the documentary. And I was one of the lead actresses in the film. I played multiple versions of myself, basically multiple emotions that I was experiencing at the same time. I had a wonderful first AD, Sharon Joseph. I had some wonderful people that continued with me on to my next project.
Your 2022 offering, Black Retail, I Need a 3-Day Weekend. I found that very interesting. Three African-American millennial women. Talk to us about that project.
Oh, Black Retail has been my baby since 2018. That's when I first started to develop it.
Okay.
I was working in retail at the time. And, you know, of course, being a Black woman in service, there are experiences of racism, of people seeing you as their help and not just someone in a store helping you, an associate guiding you through your fashion process. It was more of people wanting a personal, I'm going to say the word, kind of a personal slave at their side, kind of at their beck and call. And I was starting to write a series based on that, just Black women in retail. It's a comedy, of course, but a Black woman in retail, and what does that mean to always be absurdist? But then as I started to open up the show more and I saw that they were performing in their personal lives as well, that's when it became a little bit more deepened for me, because the same smile that they have to give to their boss and these customers that are rude to them, and it's the same smile that they have to give to family and partners and loved ones. And when do Black women actually get a chance to clock out? And so that's the center of Black Retail.
It seems that your other prior two projects, you were taking your particular project from real life experiences. Did I miss something?
No, definitely, definitely. It's been a way to not just entirely tell my particular experience, but seeing the thread from my experience and how it is connected to so many people. You know, while I was creating Next Stop and Black Retail, so many of my friends, strangers, I would go to parties and everyone were having the same conversation. So I felt validated that people will feel seen in the work, because it wasn't just me having all of these like identity questions and who am I, where do I want to be, and how am I going to try to find the balance in all of this.
When you begin a project, obviously you write it down. So at what point you kind of stray away from what your original idea is due to the fact that once you start filming, other things take place?
So I've been researching You Think You've Grown since 2016, and I made 4 projects since then. With the documentary specifically, It takes so much time to research. It is articles, it's journals, it's books, it's podcasts, it's so many things that you're consuming, because unlike a narrative film or pilot, you write it and then you shoot exactly what you wrote. The documentary, you can have points of what you want to discuss, but then you have to, it's a puzzle. You have to slowly bring it together. Even after production, you're still like piecing the movie together how it should be. And so I knew that I wanted to build my portfolio. I also wanted to build my directorial voice and know what my directorial voice was. And I knew that I wanted to lead a few more teams before I got to You Think You Grown, because I knew the impact that it needed. I knew the seriousness that it needed. I knew the focus that it needed. And maybe like 4 months after Black Retail, while I was in the editing phase, I was like, okay, I'm ready to take all of this research and piece it together to make a complete film. And I took a weekend at my sister's home in Virginia and literally like displayed everything, all highlighted research books, papers, and then built that. And I think that doing it in that way allowed me to still create, to still work, to still show people the range of me. Like, I can make a comedy pilot. I can make surrealism comedy, but also I can do drama. Like, it was able to, like, build that voice so people could trust me when it was time for You Think You Grown to be released.
What led you to the point that you thought this story needed to be told?
So I'm going to take us back to 2014. This was, like, the mustard seed that grew. I'm literally going to tell you every single step. So in 2014, there was a petition demanding, it was created by a Black woman, and it was signed by mostly Black people, over 20,000 signatures. It was a petition to demand Beyonce to straighten Blue Ivy's hair. And she's 2 years old at the time, I'm 20. And I'm watching not only this petition go viral and the comments about her big nose and her nappy hair, and I'm hearing it in beauty shops, in barbershops, in beauty supply stores, in our community. And it made me really just think about, because I don't know how adults talked about me when I was 2 years old, but now I'm hearing them talk about this two-year-old child and what she should be and what she isn't and all of these things. And then we continue 2 more years later. I'm teaching and I'm going to therapy at the same time. So I'm learning how much childhood impacts our evolution. And then I'm in school and I'm in the teacher's lounge now. I'm no longer in the student seat. And I'm hearing teachers talk about how, and I'm in a multiracial school. I've always been in a Black school, but I'm in a multiracial school and I hear teachers say, she's grown. I know she's having sex by the way she's walking. I know she's going to be on drugs. I know she's going to be a baby mama. But when the white girls have a tantrum, or if the white girls are maybe wearing a skirt too short, it is softened language. It is, oh, let's get her a sweater. Oh, she just made a little mistake. It was so much calm why the Black girl got this vitriol. And so that's what began me researching. And just so happened that that year, Georgetown had a research paper come out that was called Girl Interrupted. And it was all about the impact of adultification bias. And that was the first time that I had heard adultification said out loud, and that's when the research began.
Of the women that are portrayed in the documentary, how did you find them, and were they, obviously they were receptive, but were they taken back that you were doing this particular project?
So I'm lucky to know a lot of the women in the film, but also I'm lucky to have a beautiful casting director, Ron Artis Jr. When I pieced all of the research together and I said, okay, this is the beginning, the middle, and the end of the film. This is what we're going to do. I knew I needed therapists. I knew I needed educators. I knew I needed young girls as well, because if we're going to be talking about childhood, I need to talk to children. And so, and also I just need Black women in the space of like healing, like their work is around healing, and they're also comfortable with talking about their experiences. So I wrote an entire list down of all the women I knew that fit in all those boxes. Because I've been researching this since 2016, I have been collecting a lot of emails and a lot of people's names that they didn't even know. But I was like, this person would be good for this, this person would be good for that. And when I reached out to them, a lot of people were shocked. They were like, you just did a comedy pilot. What? But they were so much more overjoyed than they were shocked. And we had pre-interviews with everyone, so they were comfortable with the questions before we got on set. And this was 8 months before we even got on set. So they were giving like 5 preliminary questions just to get them comfortable with talking about their experiences and adultification as well. Also, I was able to use that audio to further build the film and the questions I wanted to tell later on.
I understand. You're listening to In Black America with John L. Hanson Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Chanel Dupree, founder of Artistic Laughter, writer, director, storyteller, independent filmmaker. And her recent documentary is entitled You Think You're Grown, Dismantling Adultification. Ms. Dupree, how has adultification affected you as a young lady right now?
You want me to go back to childhood
or
right now?
I heard that.
I felt like in times stunted growth. So I feel like I'm just now getting to a place when I'm processing my feelings, because when you are a Black child, girl or not, your feelings are completely negated as let that go. You're being grown. You're talking back when you're simply just expressing yourself. So my documentary goes from childhood to womanhood and how not being seen and not being heard leads you into adulthood. And I'm finding with myself now, I am fighting those voices that I heard from childhood telling me, like, your feelings don't matter, you're being grown. I'm still trying to silence those voices and listen to my own feelings, something that should have been taught well into my childhood.
The documentary moves along. Are there professionals that are articulating some of the side effects of this particular occurrence?
Yeah, we have a beautiful therapist. She specializes in sexual wellness, also in sexual trauma therapy. And her name is Dr. Nikki Coleman. She's on social media as Dr. Nikki Knows. And she speaks about, in our second and third chapter, how the sexualization of Black women, of Black girls, affects them when they get older. For example, she used catcalling on the street should be seen as a trauma and should be seen as adultification as well, because these girls are in the early stages of not knowing their bodies, but they're knowing that it's a target and they're knowing that it's an appetite for an older man. So when you get older, you don't have a sense of your own body. You don't have agency over yourself. It's hard for you to speak up for yourself. You're not comfortable in your body because it was objectified when your brain was still developing. And that was one of the biggest and brightest lessons that she gave in the film.
How has social media and the immediacy in which we live in today affecting these young women?
Ooh, I had a remarkable, remarkable conversation with three lovely young ladies, Khalees, Precious, and Jada in the film. And they spoke about how they will experience hardship with their teachers and they will go on social media for safety, for peace, for release, and see these harmful, disparaging memes about them, sometimes reposted by people that say that they are their friends. Something so beautiful one of the young ladies say, I think it was Jada and also Khalees, they said that Black women are only celebrated on social media when they are being funny or they may be made fun of. Now, these are 17 and 16-year-old young ladies. And they are seeing that from their eyes. No, you know, add in for me. I just simply asked, what does social media feel like for you? And they particularly said during the Black Lives Matter movement, it was hard to see disparaging memes about the Black people that were killed, to see the ghetto Black women content, to see a lot of comedians take on that role and build an audience making fun of them and who they are, and it allows them to not have a release. There's no space at home. I'm being bombarded with your rhetoric and back in the day ideals about who a Black girl is, and then I go into school and my teacher is being so disparaging towards me more than anyone else, and then I go on social media and it's the same thing. So it almost makes them feel trapped.
How has slavery played into the stereotype and the perception of viewing of African-American girl bodies?
Ooh, my. slavery plays a huge, huge part. Black children were never seen as children. Black girls were never seen as innocent. From the moment they were born, they were cattle. They were workers. They were immediately there to help the business. And a beautiful, beautiful professor, oh God, in my documentary, she says that a lot of mothers had to prepare their daughters mentally and spiritually for rape. Let's really sit with that. How do you prepare the mind, the body, the soul, the spirit for it to be attacked by age 10? By age 8, these little girls were already in line to bear children. They were not seen as innocent. They were not seen as this was immoral to do to them. This is just a way of life. And so us as Black people, we have beautifully shredded a lot of the things from slavery, a lot of the mentality, a lot of the thinking, but there is a few things, as oppressed people do when they are put in these situations, that we've held on to and we have to let go. Because you think you've grown directly reflects back to slavery, when these Black children were just Black bodies and nothing else.
Is there encouragement and hope prior to the end of the film?
After we talked to the young girls, our last chapter was called Shut It All Down, The Dismantling. And we talk about reconnecting to your inner child and how that alone can heal you through to the next generation when you are raising children. We talk about how do you reinvent Black womanhood for yourself? How do you apologize and give grace to that young self of yours? How are you now with your daughters, now that you have all of this information, all of this insight, and you released it? And then we end the film with a beautiful poem by Chanel Gabriel, an amazing poet and educator in NYC. And she leaves us with a breathtaking poem, and we see images of young girls playing and smiles and trees and hope. And she leaves us remembering who we are and that we are not what the past has taught us. We got such beautiful insight and guidelines on how to heal what has been hurt.
How do we go about rechanneling this particular energy that people need to understand what's going on is really harmful for these young ladies?
Beautiful question. I think that we need to drop our bias. I think that we need to know that we have a bias. Because we are severely oppressed, a lot of times we don't think that we can be oppressors, but you can be. You can be within your own community. And so I think going back and researching, if you don't think adultification is connected to slavery and you think I'm just speaking out my millennial butt, and I'm just saying anything because these girls are truly fast. Okay, well, go back and read. Read a slave journal. Read journals. Read research on this. And then have a conversation with yourself. Have I experienced it? Even Black men, when raising Black girls, have I experienced it? Because Black men also experience it as well. When they are younger and people call them, oh, my little boyfriend and my little husband, and the emotional incest that a lot of people have with Black boys. So go back into yourself and say, well, do I have bias? Go back to yourself as a Black woman. Do I have bias? Am I letting my child experience this because I did? Because that's not right. And then after you have that internal conversation with yourself, drop your bias. Before you open your mouth to have a conversation with a young girl and you maybe have an issue with her clothing, or maybe you think that she's advocating for herself too much. Who knows? Because it can be a wide range of things. Go into your psyche, go inside and say, how can I speak innocently to this child without breaking their spirit, without telling them something is wrong with them, and as this and make this a teachable moment? I think if we take all of those second steps and all of that education, I really do think we can build a better community with our children.
During this process, were the women from different educational and social backgrounds?
I had some professors from University of Kentucky. I've had some social workers, a beautiful poet, Dr. Mahogany L. Brown. We had younger therapists because I wanted to reach both sectors. You know, I have Dr. Nikki, who specializes in sexual wellness and sexual trauma therapy. And then we have Jessica, who has a lot of Black women clients, and she's a little bit fresher and newer inside of a therapeutic practice, and so they can give both perspectives from their therapeutic eye. And then, of course, we had our young ladies. Some of them grew up in the boogie down Bronx, some from Brooklyn, some in completely white schools. I wanted a full spectrum. I also had a principal. She was a principal for an all-white school and for an all-black school. I really wanted to get all different types of perspectives in this because we all experience it, not just in certain educational or socioeconomic backgrounds.
I guess one of the elephants in the room, where did the perception come from that African-American girls know more about sex than their white counterparts?
Slavery. It is literally like because black girls' bodies were violated so early on in history, in their lives, a lot of people don't like to equate what black enslaved girls and women experience with rape. That's number one. So that's where we get Jezebel from. We get Jezebel to justify the rape. We get Jezebel to justify that because you're just naturally hypersexual. You're just naturally tantalizing. No, you, because of your bias and because you believe that my body and my soul doesn't matter, you want to take from me. But our world has to flip it. It can't see us as a victim because black women can't be victims, please. So it has to be shown as, no, we know more sexually. We're more sexually experienced than black girls. Absolutely not. We've been introduced to things far sooner than we should have. And their innocence was simply just preserved longer than ours.
Before I run out of time, Ms. Dupree, was this project therapeutic for you?
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm so happy you asked that. I haven't gotten that question. Absolutely. Throughout the process of recording this, first of all, it felt so healing to the child me, the adolescent me, all versions of myself. I felt so healed and so seen in that moment. While we were shooting, we have a great sound mixer for post because it was a lot of and stomping because the crew felt it. And you know how we like to shout.
Chanel Dupree, founder of Artistic Laughter Production, award-winning screenwriter and director. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Let's go back a couple years ago to a special that was aired on Pittsburgh's WQED.
Across America, and right here in Pittsburgh, a disturbing trend is putting the future of African-American girls at risk. It's called adultification. It's the perception that black girls are more adult, more aggressive, and less in need of support and care than their white counterparts.
I feel like in a way, adultification dehumanizes a child because it doesn't give you, like, it takes away the child part of you.
What studies have shown is that black girls are viewed as older, less innocent, more adult-like than their white peers.
Are you happy? I am happy. I am excited. Blessing, let me ask you this. What's the number one thing that you feel like you are?
Kind.
I am kind, and that's beautiful.
It's a perception that can take black girls out of the classroom and plunge them into the juvenile justice system.
Our focus is really on understanding and disrupting the high rates of referrals of Black girls to juvenile justice.
Join us as we explore the causes and the consequences and talk to the people who are fighting to change perceptions.
When we see that these statistics are showing racial inequities and they're showing disproportionate negative impacts on children of color, on Black children, what do we do about it?
And give Black girls the childhoods they deserve.
And just imagine if the barriers that are often put in front of them were not there and they were just able to thrive with the support of the adults that are supposed to be protecting them, how much more amazing they could be.
Our region is facing its share of challenges: the coronavirus, police violence.
How you justify that? How you justify that?
What side are you on, my people? What side are you on?
Calls for racial and social justice have all had an impact. Recently, a widely read report has shed a light on the shocking racial disparities in our city. And the devastating long-term effects racism and poverty have on the lives of African-American women and girls. Dr. Jamelia Blake is a professor of educational psychology at Texas A&M.
So adultification bias is the perception of Black girls, and by extension Black children, as being more adult-like than their stated age. When you see this child, you see this child as an adult or being older, and so you expect them to know more. You don't believe that they're innocent. You hold them as being more culpable for any kind of misdeeds or actions. Yeah, so actually the whole concept of adultification bias came from what we were seeing in terms of disparate rates in school suspensions and juvenile justice contact for Black girls. What happens is when this adultification bias is activated is that when Black girls make a mistake in the classroom, or when they ask a question, or when they, you know, raise an idea, or when, you know, any type of movement, what happens is adultification bias allows those stereotypes of Black women to be mapped onto Black girls' behavior. And that's where you get this overly punitive response to what's really benign and even developmentally appropriate and normal behavior. So when that happens, it results in Black girls being sent out the classroom. That escalates to suspensions, right? And this starts to create this cycle.
I feel like in a way, adultification dehumanizes a child, because it doesn't give you, like, it takes away the child part of you.
But for Black girls, our stereotypes are different, right? And that has to do with racism and sexism. So the over-policing, the surveillance, the over-suspension has to do with the perception of Black women and Black girls as being aggressive. The hypersexualization of Black women and girls, all of those things contribute to adultification bias.
But like, they will look at me as like I'm older and hold me to a certain expectation. But a white girl or someone of a different ethnicity could be wearing the same exact outfit but with a different build, and it's normalized on them.
It does not mean that young woman is trying to portray herself in a sexualized manner. She's just wearing clothing. Right. And so this is something that as our society and our communities, this is the beauty of this kind of research, in my opinion, because it's forcing us to have conversations that we've not had to have conversations before about.
Pittsburgh civil rights attorney Thena Robinson Mock also sees the dangers of adultification bias.
So the criminalization of students of color and Black students is the process by which young people are entering school environments, and they are being met with an environment that unfairly punishes them, that stigmatizes them. Black girls absolutely suffer disproportionately from criminalization and adultification. And the way that that manifests from day to day is that it's perceived that Black girls are worthy of less protection, that they don't need to be comforted, that they are more adult-like in their behaviors, and they're not given the benefit of doubt of childhood.
The idea of racism, I think it shouldn't be there because, like, we all came from, you can believe it or not, but we all came from the same place.
We need more adults in the building who are trained to really see children for who they are and to help them navigate all of the complicated feelings of life. A school is a microcosm of a community. And so if we are finding that, for instance, families are having a hard time with making ends meet, you know, generally, or if Black families are struggling, if health indicators are low, that's going to, I think, play into our everything from racial bias to how we're looking at young people inside of schools.
Professor Sarah Goodkind of the University of Pittsburgh has written extensively on the inequities facing Black girls.
The report looked at inequities affecting Black girls in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County. It came out in 2016. It was really instigated by a large group of people locally who had begun in a bunch of different settings to talk about some of the systemic barriers and challenges that Black girls in our region were facing.
The report focused on five target areas: poverty, education, juvenile justice, violence and abuse, and child welfare.
We focused on those areas because when we came together to discuss these systemic barriers, those were, I think, both the areas that the different people who had come together were working in, and also because part of what we were doing, as I was saying, was to really understand the connections across these different systems. I think poverty underlies a lot and is related to a lot of the other challenges, so that was kind of a place to start, especially as we saw that we had really high levels of poverty among Black girls and Black youth in our city and county. Part of what we were looking at through other systems is this knowledge that once young people get caught up in some of the different systems, it's often hard to get out. And a lot of the work that we're doing to look at these systemic barriers is to help us collectively think about how could we support Black girls, Black boys, Black families, everyone in our city and county sooner and in less kind of punitive ways. We talk a lot in social work, which is my field, about putting ourselves out of work, right? We really don't want young people entering these systems. I think the disproportionate rates of school discipline that Black girls experience affect them in many, many different ways. I think it starts even before Black girls experience school discipline in terms of what we're seeing is that the same kinds of behaviors that white and Black youth might engage in school are responded to really differently. And I think that happens from a very young age before we even call it officially school discipline, right? Just maybe how a teacher responds and who's encouraged to speak up and speak out and share their experiences and their opinions in the classrooms. Obviously, I'm not an expert on what it's like to be a Black girl in school, but the research shows us that that from a very young age, these experiences accumulate, and even when some are small and some are bigger, that then students learn that, you know, what they have to say is not important, right? If they are silenced when they are excited in class and speak up and try to contribute.
I would like for things to be a little bit different, a little bit less harsh. You know, I understand school is school, and they're like, oh, well, this could distract this student, this could distract this student. I'm just personally like, I don't think think that's, I don't think, I think that's absurd. I think that's very uncalled for.
While Pittsburgh is known for its charming neighborhoods and friendly residents, it also leads locally and nationally in disproportionate treatment of Black girls in our schools. Pittsburgh Public Schools are the largest of 43 school districts in Allegheny County and second largest in Pennsylvania. Angela Alley is the school district's executive director of equity.
The equity office was created out of a complaint filed by the Advocates for African American Students against the district, citing racial discrimination that led to glaring racial disparities between Black and white students. We have, for instance, the district's second equity plan. This is our most comprehensive equity plan, On Track to Equity, that was released in 2019. And it lays out several action steps the district is taking to be able to affect racial equity. I think the first step is always to recognize we have a problem, and we have a systemic problem. And so I think that's first and foremost, as I mentioned, really being able to identify the problem and not place that the burden or perception of the problem on the young people. So we, as the adults and the researchers and practitioners, we must come together and we must examine our system, the system we help to build and help to perpetuate, that is producing these types of outcomes. And that takes us to step two. The superintendent is going to be hearing from the board as to whether or not they will approve a third party, an independent third party contract, to be able to look at our data and track, disaggregate the data, and track incidents of calls made to the police from which buildings, from which schools, citations, arrests, so we can begin to really address this head on.
Calls for reexamining policing policies are a big part of the juvenile justice conversation, with some districts completely revamping their approach.
Black girls are often suspended and expelled at higher rates, particularly Black girls with disabilities. And when we talk about a school-based arrest and the implication of police in schools, Black girls suffer from the presence of police in schools because their behavior is unfairly criminalized. And while we know that we want to keep students safe, absolutely, what's happened is that police presence has been disproportionately placed inside of schools.
At Amachi, Pittsburgh, Maria Searcy leads a group of girls on a morning filled with affirmation and positivity.
Whatever you have in your head, whatever you know that you are, whatever you feel that you are, and whatever you feel you can be, I want you to just go up to your post. It doesn't matter which one you go to, and start writing, I am. I'm working with families, Amachi families, to basically empower young minds and strengthen the families. So I became an advocate at the local and state level within 3 years of my children's elementary school education. But the understanding of adultification began a long time ago. Just seeing our children in school systems where there's poor child, where there's disparate treatment. You know, what we want to say is, well, they're adultified at home. So there are kids who are, you know, have responsibilities at home that look like adults, taking care of younger children and you know, and cooking and being at home by themselves, but not understanding what perpetuates that. What perpetuates that? And I know for certain that it's racism and poverty.
According to the Pittsburgh Inequality Report, Black women are more likely to do better in any other city than Pittsburgh.
We can't have people who adultify our children, who don't like our children, and can't identify with our children, making unilateral decisions for our children. It's not working.
Anna Hollis is the executive director of Amachi Pittsburgh.
So our goal is really to make sure kids have a fighting chance. You know, I mean, these are children who have so many odds stacked against them from community schools and, you know, just systemic oppression overall in society.
Back up, back up. Freedom, freedom, all these racists have come. We don't need them, need them.
I think what's happening in society at large is, you know, also happening in classrooms with kids. And, you know, that whole, you know, a lot of assumptions about who Black people are and just negative perceptions. And, you know, some people call it implicit bias. And sometimes it is implicit bias, and sometimes it's just downright overt racism.
I feel like they, at the first sight that they see me, you know, they might look down on me, like she's lazy or she doesn't want to do anything, or no, you know, you might not know what she's going to do.
But I think what we need to do together is, beyond having the difficult conversations about, you know, these issues, is really finding solutions. And so when, you know, so when the data is showing that there are racial disparities, the individuals who are creating those disparities need to be held accountable. And it's, and need to be supported and educated and provided the training and resources that they need to serve Black children and all children effectively.
If you invest in girls now, you're definitely investing in the future.
Gwyn's Girls was founded in 2002 by Commander Gwyn Elliott, one of the city's first African-American police commanders. The Northside nonprofit has helped thousands of girls by providing educational, emotional, and community-based support. Kathy Elliott is the CEO of Gwyn's Girls and convener of the Black Girls Equity Alliance.
The Black Girls Equity Alliance is a collaboration that was formed back in 2016 following our first equity summit, and that was following a report that came out around the inequities of Black girls here in Allegheny County.
According to the report, these pathways play a significant role in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County.
And we specifically looked at the rates of Black children being referred to the juvenile justice system. And the main pathways are from school. So literally we have data that supports the school to prison pipeline phenomenon. Specifically we looked at charges that typically kind of have children being referred to that system. The other way is through fines and citations, summary citations, and usually those come from either the police or the magistrate. We can see some of the same things that happen in other school districts that our children do. They end up in the juvenile justice system or referred to the police, or teachers call the police. Like removing all the different potential scenarios or reasons. For me, the only thing that we can come up with is systemic racism, because we have data that shows that there are white children that commit the same types of behaviors, because I don't want to call them crimes, because oftentimes it's behaviors that are not seen as acceptable. And the most frequently used charge was disorderly conduct. don't think that all referrals to law enforcement or to the juvenile justice system is done out of maliciousness or, you know, oftentimes it is, you know, people concerned, teachers or administrators feeling that they want to get them help. And the systems themselves, you know, say that we're not geared to give the help that's needed. And oftentimes it's mental health.
Well, what teachers often don't know is going on with young people, and in this case we're talking about Black girls, is that there are so many different challenges happening in a young person's world and reality.
There's, like, people have different personalities. Like, yeah, like, when you first meet somebody, it might seem mean, but, like, maybe it's because they have a story and you don't know it.
Working towards solutions, the Black Girls Equity Alliance held a virtual town hall meeting with leading systems representatives.
It started the something that I've not seen happen here in Allegheny County of having all the different entities at the table at the same time. So we can't just say it's the education system because it's not. We can't just say it's the juvenile justice system because it's not. We can't even just say it's the child welfare system because it's not. It's pieces of all those systems that have to work together because and talk to one another and potentially come up with solutions so that, you know, we're really truly addressing the issues and preventing kids from ending up in any of these systems in a negative way.
Everyone, start your engines! Okay?
It's a fun evening at home for Sylvia, Sammy, and Sierra. But at UPMC Children's Hospital, it's a different kind of adventure.
So my name is Sylvia Wusuansa. I am a pediatrician, a pediatric emergency medicine physician, an EMS physician, and currently associate vice chair of diversity, equity, and inclusion at UPMC Children's Hospital, and a mom of two beautiful girls. Sierra is a very creative human being and uses her left brain more. Sammy is very active, rambunctious 4-year-old.
What do you think of when you hear the word adultification?
You know, right off the bat, I think of growing up too early. You know, as a pediatrician, you know, I think of a kid just needing to be a kid. You know, it's easy to see it for yourself. It's harder to see it for your children, and you almost don't want to because it's so painful. I'll give you another example, again, with the little one, which really shocked me, was we're sitting out in our backyard just talking, and out of nowhere she burst, "I don't want to be a Black girl." And several emotions just shot through my brain, my heart, because I never imagined that that would come out of her lips or what would give her reason to that, especially in the household that she's grown up in. And so that enlightened me a lot to say that me, myself, I have a lot of learning to do as to where our girls are and what they're being exposed to and how they're being envisioned. You know, the thing that I always say is people need to understand that our Black girls, you know, are first and foremost, they're human. You know, nothing less than human beings. And why not have them reach their potential? Because they are capable of changing this world.
So how do we challenge adultification and its negative outcomes?
I think a lot of that work needs to start with ourselves. So when I was saying before that each of us needs to listen and learn and come back and reflect on what we're doing and ways that we might be unintentionally reinforcing racist practices, that's a start.
What makes young people feel safe are building powerful relationships with adults in the building, knowing that they can show up to a school where they are seen and heard and valued.
So what I want for children's future is for them to understand they are perfectly made in God's image, that they have gifts and talents to succeed and be anything they want to be.
And just imagine if the barriers that are often put in front of them were not there and they were just able to thrive
with the support of the adults that are supposed to be protecting them, how much more amazing they could be.
Years of entrenched systems won't change overnight, but it's a future all Black girls deserve.
And I would like for people to understand that we are not a threat. Okay, we're normal girls, okay? Like, I would like for people to understand the importance of our hair, our culture, our heritage, like, our skin color. Just understand us. Like, I would like for people to just understand who we are. And I think that would make a difference.
That is something that was recorded back in November of 2020 on a WQED in Pittsburgh, and the title of the piece is called "Childhood Loss: The Adultification of African American Girls Across America." And here in Pittsburgh, a disturbing trend is putting the future of African American girls at risk. It's called adultification. A perception that Black girls are more aggressive and less deserving of support and care. A perception that can also lead to negative outcomes and that takes them from the classroom to the courtroom. And they talked to various people in this special and that were challenging the systems and working for change. From WQED Pittsburgh, from November 21st, 2020, was when it was first posted online. So I wanted to share that with you folks. Thank you for listening today.
I just had another dizzy spell and almost fell. I'm scared they will get worse and never go away.
You're not alone. 69 million people suffer from dizziness and vertigo.
I wonder if there's help.
There is. The Vestibular Disorders Association has a helpline at 800-837-8428 or visit liferebalanced.org.
Can you repeat that?
800-837-8428 or liferebalanced.org.
Sponsored by the Vestibular Disorders Association.
Medicaid and CHIP offer free or low-cost health coverage for children and teens. Hospital and doctor visits, prescriptions, shots, and more are covered. That's peace of mind for parents if a child is sick or gets injured. And parents may now be eligible for Medicaid too, even if they've applied in the past. Enrollment is always open. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 1-877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Over the past few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has affected how we live our daily lives.
Today, 1 in 5 Americans experience emotional and mental health challenges, but many of us do not understand what we are facing or how to ask for help.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental health.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to...
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, one of many things wrong with corporate news media is the way they hammer home the idea that the current system is the only system. If you don't see yourself and your interests reflected in either of the two dominant political parties, well, the problem is you. Part of the value of independent media
is that the people they listen to give us new questions to ask. For example, how do we acknowledge the fact that many people's opinions are shaped by messages that are created and paid for by people who work very hard to hide their identity and their interests? If we're in an open debate about what's best for all of us, why can't we see who pays you? We'll talk about dark money in politics with Steve Masick. He's professor and chair of communication and media studies at North Central College in Illinois, and his recent piece, Dark Money Uncovered, appeared on the progressive.org. That's coming up, but first, a quick look back at some recent press. Phil Donahue, a friend of Fair and a rare champion of progressive issues on corporate airwaves, died on August 18th. Fair founder Jeff Cohen was a senior producer of Donahue's MSNBC primetime show. Cohen recounts that while a lot of mainstream obituaries seem most interested in Donahue's daytime TV episodes that included male strippers or whatever, Donahue's most frequent guests on his daytime show were Ralph Nader, Gloria Steinem, and Jesse Jackson. He also regularly hosted Sidney Wolfe, warning of the harmful greed of the pharmaceutical industry. And while he was raised a Catholic, Donahue often featured advocates for atheism. But Donahue was on MSNBC in the run-up to the so-called War on Terror, when corporate media were awash in rampant warmongering. Liberal media hero Dan Rather told David Letterman at the time, "George Bush is the president. Wherever he wants me to line up, just tell me where." So NBC executives couldn't reconcile Donahue's platforming of anti-war activists or his insistence on asking difficult questions of D.C. decision makers. So they first mandated a thumb on the scales. As Jeff Cohen writes, quote, "If we had booked one guest who was anti-war, we needed to book two that were pro-war. If we had two guests on the left, we needed three on the right. When a producer suggested booking Michael Moore, known to oppose the pending Iraq war, she was told she'd need to book three right-wingers for political balance," close quote. And then 3 weeks before the Iraq war started and after some of the biggest anti-war mobilizations the world had ever seen, the network canceled Donahue's show. A leaked internal memo said Donahue represented, quote, "a difficult public face for NBC at a time of war," close quote. Now, after Donahue's death and more than 20 years after the New York Times got the story famously and catastrophically wrong about the Iraq War, the paper of record still can't forgive anyone who was right or even asking questions. As The Intercept's John Schwartz pointed out on X, formerly Twitter, anyone teaching a class on how to slime people in a subtle, scuzzy way in the New York Times could start with this paragraph from the paper's obituary. Quote, "In 2002, Mr. Donahue tried a comeback with a nightly talk show on MSNBC. Barely 6 months in, the program was canceled. He said later that network executives were unhappy with his fervent liberalism and his opposition to the looming war in Iraq. In 2007, he co-produced and co-directed an anti-war documentary, Body of War. It hardly helped that his ratings lacked far behind those of competitors on Fox News and CNN. Close quote. Well, indeed, Donahue did say that executives were unhappy with his political stances and his opposition to the war. And you remember who else said that? NBC executives, as reported at the time by such hard-to-find outlets as CNN and The Washington Post. And indeed, Donahue's ratings did lag far behind those of competitors on Fox News and CNN. His show was also the top-rated show on MSNBC. But apparently today's New York Times can't be expected to convey that, because after all, it was reported at the time only in such publications.